resilient individuals learn from their experience, they adapt to change, they maintain a positive mindset, and they're tenacious.
It's almost as though it's not a question of either analysis or intuition in the way they approach decision making, but it's this skillful blend of both intuition and analysis that gives them that edge.
When charismatic CEOs and leaders also lack empathy, this is a recipe for disaster.
Narcissism is an intoxication with self, whereas hubris is an intoxication with power and success. If narcissism is an illness of the person, then hubris is an illness of a position.
So the leaders that seem to be the most resilient and that seem to be the most successful are leaders that are high in emotional intelligence.
If there is an antidote to the hubris hazard, I think it's humility.
Welcome, everyone. I am Thomas Morino, a director in the digital practice at management consultancy firm Alix Partners. Thank you for joining another episode of Startup Sessions, where we have been exploring the life in the world of born digital tech businesses, all of which were at one point startups. Today, we are closing out our first season, where we have a slightly different discussion plan for today, focusing specifically on areas of business leadership in this type of environment. What drives founders and leaders to begin their startup journey? How can they effectively handle the different stages of growth and at some point even let go of their baby? And how do the leadership traits at the top contribute or even constrict an organization's development? To tackle all of this and more, I'm sure, I'm delighted to be joined by Ted Bilillis, PhD, head of our Alix Partners Transformative Leadership Practice, and Eugene Sadler-Smith, author and professor of organizational behavior at Surrey Business School at the University of Surrey, UK. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you, Thomas. Great to be here.
Thank you, Thomas. Yeah, great to be here as well.
So perhaps to get us started, I'd like to perhaps start on the typical traits that you see of leaders who are willing to effectively make the leap and strike out on their own and start founding a new business. Ted, perhaps if I start with you, and then we'd love to hear your thoughts as well, Eugene.
Sure, Thomas. So the psychological makeup of founders and leaders of startups can vary widely, of course, but there are some common traits and common characteristics that are associated with successful entrepreneurs. One would be risk tolerance. So successful entrepreneurs typically have a very high tolerance for risk. They can step out of their comfort zone. They can navigate uncertainty in the pursuit of ambitious goals. Second, they tend to be very resilient. Obviously, there are a lot of failures and setbacks in the beginning of any enterprise, and resilience is an absolute essential ingredient in the entrepreneurial journey. So resilient individuals learn from their experience, they adapt to change, they maintain a positive mindset, and they're tenacious. They're adaptable, and they're tenacious, and they're creative. So those are a few qualities that we see across the spectrum of common traits and characteristics of entrepreneurs and leadership.
Thank you, Ted. Eugene, would you like to add something to this?
Yeah, fascinating the points that Ted's made there. Maybe if I could pick up on a couple of things that he said. The first is this issue about risk tolerance, and then the implicit in that was this idea about the ability to spot opportunities in the environment that other people may be oblivious to. So if we take the issue of risk tolerance, one of the stereotypes that I think some people have of entrepreneurs is that they're kind of gung-ho people who go with their gut no matter what. But I think if we look at the research into differences between different occupational groups, and my particular interest is in intuition, I'm fascinated about whether this stereotype of the entrepreneur as the kind of the intuitive type who goes with their gut all of the time, if there's any kind of validity to that. And I think if we look at the data, it's not the case, actually. what we tend to find in successful entrepreneurs is that what they tend to do is to balance their intuition, their feel for a situation, their ability to spot an opportunity with the kind of rigorous analytical skills to judge the viability of that. So it's almost as though they're using two mindsets at once. They're using their intuition to spot the opportunities, but they're also then, rather than just going with their gut, they're actually balancing that with the ability to analyze the situation and judge the viability of whether the opportunity is something that they could follow. So that's something that fascinates me, this idea of entrepreneurial alertness and how do they manage that. It's almost as though it's not a question of either analysis or intuition in the way they approach decision making, but it's this skillful blend of both intuition and analysis that gives them that edge and the ability to capitalize on an opportunity.
Very interesting, thank you. And do you think perhaps that this kind of mix of intuition and analytical skills, how do you see that evolving as the business kind of grows? So we talk about often different stages, first an incubation, then a phase of kind of maturation and then expansion. How do you see those skill set evolving as the business also evolves?
I think if you take it right back to basics, I think one of the key things that an entrepreneurial mindset has to have in it is this ability to spot an opportunity, and maybe to spot opportunities that other people are actually blind to. So in a sense that the entrepreneurial mindset is an alert mindset that sees things that other people tend to miss. And I think that takes us right back to the beginning of the entrepreneurial to the business venturing process. And that's something that's quite hard to pin down, you know, because it's related to a point that Ted made about creativity and this ability to make the connections between dots, to join dots together. But Steve Jobs said, it's impossible to join dots if you don't have the dots in place in the first place. So you have to have the dots to be able to connect them. So this is this idea of the kind of deep immersion in the field that you're venturing into, but then also this ability to see connections that other people can't see.
And what about you, Ted? What would you say about the evolving mindset of the entrepreneur as their company grows?
Well, as the company grows, I mean, the fundamental notion there that we see in successful entrepreneurs that grow with their companies is that they are reinventing themselves. They understand that there is no one fixed set of traits or abilities, but that they need to change as their organization gets bigger. The obvious one there, an obvious example, would be delegating responsibility to others, letting go of control. Another example would simply be understanding the stakeholders around the table. So they need to take care of a growing number of employees, but they need to take care of their boards and investors and people that they're getting capital from. It all becomes rather complex. And of course, what successful founders and entrepreneurs understand is that in some cases they have to grow new skills to be able to successfully manage those stakeholders. In other cases, they need to really look in the mirror and make some outright changes in what they're able to do. This is a very, very difficult pivot. And some people cannot do it, you know, which is why you have a fairly limited number of founders that 5 years later, 10 years later, are the CEOs of their companies. But some are able to do it. And it all starts with the ability to carefully, accurately assess one's strengths and weaknesses and to make the requisite changes as the organization grows.
Yeah. What I have found interesting in interviewing all those people is how they're easily branded as disruptors. But one, I think they're not disruptors. They're probably more manifesting a disruption that's already there. And two, they're quite... Maybe if they're disrupting something is themselves in how they basically how themselves are sort of absorbed into the enterprise and what they want to put out as a product and as a company. And perhaps as a segue, I know both of you have done a lot of research in two topics which I think are quite close. One is narcissistic leadership and the other one is hubristic leadership. Maybe they're not that close at all, but perhaps it'd be interesting to understand a little bit more of those concepts and then to see how those either playing or actually might restrict the ability of a leader to grow these type of companies. Ted, do you want to get us started on this?
you know, many of the most productive characteristics of effective leaders, of effective CEOs, are qualities such as self-confidence, charm, the ability to boldly sell a vision for a company. These are very valuable qualities, but there's a dark side to these qualities with some CEOs. So when charismatic CEOs and leaders also lack empathy, which means they don't think about or care about the consequences of their actions for others, they're maniacally self-serving, this is a recipe for disaster. Narcissistic CEOs, and we've known quite a few in our headlines in the last decade, have a constant need, or nearly constant need, for praise, and as well as the inability to receive bad news. So we can all imagine in a startup situation, there's lots of bad news. There's lots of difficult, often bad decisions. And the narcissistic CEOs are the fragile ones that can't receive that bad news. In a sense, their company is their mirror. And looking into the mirror, they really need to hear praise. They really need to see positive things. From a leadership perspective, that quickly devolves into the CEO having a group of yes men and yes women around him or her, right? The executive leadership team quickly becomes either all folks in agreement or people that then end up leaving the firm. And so narcissism is a very divisive characteristic of leaders that can have some really devastating consequences. Again, towards their board, towards their investors, they can be very charming. They can be very charismatic. They can gain, you know, considerable capital. But then from the perspective of actually running their organizations, it can be, they can take people on a very, very dangerous ride. There's also something called the dark triad, which is about, it's a concept about 20 years old, in which there are actually three qualities combined in a charismatic individual. There's narcissism, there's psychopathy, and there's Machiavellianism. So there's manipulation, there's impulsiveness, callousness, and self-importance. So again, the dark side of the charismatic CEO, one needs to be very, very cautious of, whether you're an employee, whether you're an investor, whether you're a partner. It can be very dangerous.
And from your end, Eugene, how does that relate to the concept of hubristic leadership? I think there are some common traits, for example, in terms of not being a good listener and attentive to what's effectively feedback in the environment. But perhaps you can build a bit more on this.
Yeah. Just to wind a little bit back into what Ted said. He talked about this. He listed kind of the attributes that we'd look for in a successful business leader, a CEO, or an entrepreneur: so confidence, ambition, pride, etc., etc. But I guess there's a paradox at work here, and Ted alluded to it there. And I call it this strengths into weaknesses paradox. So a strength, if it's overexercised, actually becomes a weakness. So confidence becomes overconfidence. Ambition becomes overambition. Pride becomes inauthentic pride, which then slides into these negative leadership behaviors. And then Ted's given a really good summary there of narcissism and what we need to look out for in narcissists. And then Thomas, you've raised this issue about hubris. But I think it's important to kind of separate the two things out in our heads, because I think narcissism does predispose a leader to hubris, but they're not the same thing. And the easiest way I use to understand this in my own head is to say, well, narcissism is an intoxication with self, whereas hubris is an intoxication with power and success. And then the other subtlety about the difference between them is as follows. So narcissism is a trait. You know, it's something that Freud studied, and it's been written about a lot in psychotherapy and psychoanalysis and so on and so forth. So it's a trait. It's deeply rooted. It's deeply seated. It may even go back to childhood experiences. On the other hand, hubris is not a trait. You're not born hubristic. Hubris is an acquired condition. It's a state. It's a condition that can arise and which can abate almost as quickly as it arises. So, in a sense, if narcissism is an illness of the person, then hubris is an illness of a position. It's something that's acquired by a CEO or an entrepreneur in the process of building a business or in the process of building an organization. And therefore, I think it's something that's less difficult to manage, actually, than narcissism. I think narcissistic leaders, you know, because it's trait-like and it's deeply rooted, that's much more difficult to unpick than hubris, which is this acquired condition. And I think we can put things in place to, you know, prevention is better than cure, to prevent hubris from taking hold. So I think there's that difference between them. They are linked. They're close cousins, but they shouldn't be conflated.
Understood. And Ted was talking about how a narcissistic leader might be seductive to an investor because of the kind of sway that they can have. Do you see on the hubris front, I would have two questions in one, I suppose. Do you think on the hubris front, there's perhaps a mode of selection as well for people who are either more prone to hubris or who effectively, because of their career and their successes, effectively fall into hubris? And then the kind of flip side of this is, because you talk about something that's essentially a quality that goes into effectively a deficiency, what do you see then as the impact of, you know, the hubris? A, how does it emerge? But then how does it impact company performance as well in kind of return?
Yeah, I think unlike narcissism, which I think you can get a handle on by looking at the leader themselves, because it's part of their psyche, it's part of their psychological makeup. I don't think we can really understand hubris or manage hubris without looking at the leader and the context in which they're situated. So Ted talked about the dark triad, but in hubris research, we've got something else called the toxic triangle. And really what that's saying is that hubris is a product of three things. First of all, yeah, of course, you've got to have a hubristic leader in place in the first instance. But then it's also about the context in which they're located and the complicitness of the followers. So those three ingredients together, the hubristic leader, the conducive context, the complicit followers, I think it's when those three things occur together, that's when the hubris hazard is at its most potent and at its most dangerous. So I don't think we can understand hubris or manage it without looking at the leader in the context in which they're located.
And what do you see then the impact of this in terms of the broader company's performance, its culture? And because you're talking about effectively an environment that facilitates hubris, I guess it's perhaps a bit of a two-way street.
If we're looking for an example of where hubris has arisen and has caused big problems for entrepreneurs, well, you know, we don't need to look very far. Elizabeth Holmes at Theranos, or Sam Bankman-Fried at the crypto firm FTX. You know, he was branded the king of crypto, and I think both cases are fascinating because I think that's in both of them we see this toxic mixture of the conducive context, the complicit followers, and the hubris of the leader in the first place. And, you know, we talk about consequences. Well, Elizabeth Holmes was found guilty on numerous counts of wire fraud. She's now serving a sentence of 11 and three quarter years in a prison in Texas, I believe. And Sam Bankman-Fried, the last time I looked at his case, he's found guilty and now he's awaiting sentencing, and that could result in a very long jail sentence. But the point about hubris is it's not only impactful on the individual leader themselves, it's also in both of those cases, in the Theranos case and in the FTX case, the investors lost out as well.
And from your side, Ted, in terms of narcissistic leadership, how do you see this also unraveling and impacting either culture or performance or how the company is run?
Well, I think a number of things that Eugene said certainly ring true. This notion of the narcissistic or hubristic leader needing an audience. That audience could be investors, that audience could be employees, you know, that audience could be the media. You know, there's something that I talk about often, which is the search for the magical leader. We see this even in private equity quite a bit, where investors become seduced by a very charismatic, very compelling inventor, CEO, founder, you know, say what you will, but then they're able to kind of infuse that person with all kinds of abilities, and that person doesn't dissuade or do anything to counter that grandiosity. And they go down a road together, kind of the blind leading the blind, if you will, to some very, very dangerous circumstances. So that whole interaction of the leadership with followership is much more prevalent, I think, than we're all aware of, with of course devastating consequences. And I think, you know, this goes back in some ways to how we're raising children, how we're educating students, how we're really running businesses. It's one of those hazards of capitalism that when you have your values in a particular configuration, when you emphasize, you know, achievement or you emphasize financial gain to the exclusion of other motivations, that can have really devastating consequences.
So what advice? So if I just look at it from an investor standpoint, and you know, what advice would you give them to kind of look at for effectively in a leader? Whether they are either making an investment or they're assembling a team for an existing investment, what sort of advice would you give the people in that position?
So we do this every day for our private equity investors. We submit the management teams that they're going to back, that they're going to invest in. We submit those management teams to very rigorous interviews as well as testing. So I say to all of our clients, there are really three or four things you absolutely must do, hopefully before you fall in love with an investment idea or with a charismatic CEO. One is to talk to former subordinates and make sure, you know, this is not the time to trust your gut if you're an investor and a board member. Do your due diligence, have honest, privileged conversations with former employees, colleagues who know the individual well. Do an outside objective assessment of that individual's personality. That's something that we do at Alex Partners, I think, better than anybody. We use a multimodal approach to actually evaluating the maturity and the psychological stability of the leader. Be hyper vigilant to instances of unethical behavior. Narcissists genuinely believe that the rules don't apply to them. So at the first sign of impropriety, don't excuse that away. Don't overlook it. That's really important. And don't let the individual control the narrative. So again, whether it's through reference checking, talking to former colleagues, doing the assessment, challenge that person you're going to invest in a constructive and, you know, very civil way, of course, but guard against your own desire to be seduced by, you know, what will most likely be an extremely persuasive and charismatic entrepreneur.
And Eugene, would you like to build up a bit on that?
Yeah,
as well?
to develop that really crucial point that Ted's made, because he in the running there, he used the phrase gut feeling or gut instinct, and it's really easy to be beguiled by it. Because it's so powerful, it's so potent, it can actually sway us in the wrong sorts of directions. So, you know, we think about intuition as, you know, it's got a bright side, but it's also got a dark side, and it can lead us into all sorts of difficult situations and difficult circumstances if we trust it in an undiscerning way. And I think, you know, there's been a fair amount of research looking at business angels and investors and how they judge business propositions, how they judge startups, how they judge pitches. And the smart ones, They treat their intuition as a data point, as a piece of data. That, you know, this idea of person perception is a piece of data, but it can't be the only source of data. It should never be the only source of data. Alongside that gut feel data point, which, let's face it, we can't factor out because we're human beings and it happens whether we like it or not. Alongside that person perception data, there's also got to be, and this is the point I think that Ted was making, this whole picture of the business viability data. And if the two things stack up, so if the business viability and the person perception are in agreement, you know, that's a yes, that's a green light, But I think if either one of them is out of kilter, so if the business viability data stack up, but your gut feel for the person doesn't, then maybe look into the business viability data and vice versa. If your gut feel says yes, but the business viability data says no, then really your gut feeling about the person needs to be scrutinized, needs to be subjected to all sorts of tools and techniques that are available, like devil's advocacy, pre-morteming a decision as opposed to the post-mortem. You know, prevention is better than cure. So there are all sorts of tools and techniques that people can use to de-bias and debug their intuitive mind and prevent it from sabotaging a sound decision.
Yeah. So if I just take us back just a little bit from this, and perhaps still in the same vein of intuition. So we obviously live in times where disruption is sort of permanent, and that's sort of the rule. The pace of disruption and the kind of nature of it, I think, is something that business leaders are confronted with on a daily basis. Eugene, what would you say are the most important strengths and qualities that you'd want in a leader in a time like this?
Okay, so Jeff Bezos says, if you can take a decision with data and analytics, you should do so. But what we have to accept is that a lot of situations, the data and the analytics aren't actually going to be there. So the example that Jeff Bezos gave in an interview at the Economic Club of Washington was the decision to go with Amazon Prime. Now, how many Amazon Primes had Jeff Bezos implemented before? Zero. No one had been there. It was uncharted territory. The data, the business analytics, didn't really tell him what the probability of success would be. So it wasn't possible to put a figure on the risk. And therefore, so in those situations, which are not situations of risk, where a probability can be put on an outcome of a judgment, these are situations of uncertainty. And these are really are the difficult decisions to deal with. But they're the most crucial ones. And a lot of the times, if we look at case studies of Netflix, of Amazon, numerous other examples, in those kind of big decisions, then there's lots of stories out there in the popular business press of business leaders who've trusted their gut in those situations and in those uncertain situations because there's an absence of data. And you talked about the fast pace of the environment. And in fast-moving, fast-paced, data-poor environments, often a decision-maker may not have any other option but to choose to follow that. But it's a gamble. There's an inherent risk involved in doing so. And I think it comes back to this point, I guess, all the time I go back to this idea of both and, not either or. So it's this question, you know, the ability to actually balance your intuitions, your intuitive judgment with your analytics. And if you can't do it because you're an intuitive type, if there is such a thing, then of course, it's then about stepping back a little bit and bringing other people into the team who can counterbalance your kind of your intuitive style with a more analytical style.
Thank you, Eugene. Ted, do you want to add up to this?
So, you know, I think in really successful CEOs, particularly the ones in the earlier phases, we see three things. We see adaptability, flexibility, and a willingness to learn. So this notion that, you know, and by the way, willingness to learn from anyone. So leaders who remain on a hierarchical stage are really going to find themselves behind the curve, especially in the age of AI, where knowledge can come and often does come from much younger workers. Anything that looks like a hierarchical leader, anything that looks like a man or woman who's kind of seeing their organization in levels and really wants to stay at the top level, they're behind the curve from the beginning. So, you know, we see, you know, for success in leadership, we see flexibility, the ability to adapt, the ability to listen, not to everyone, but to many, many people. And knowing that they're going to find value and understanding at various levels of the organization. In short, Thomas, I think what we're really talking about is emotional intelligence. So the leaders that seem to be the most resilient and that seem to be the most successful are leaders that are high in emotional intelligence. And emotional intelligence, as we all know, is comprised of self-awareness, self-regulation, empathy, social skills and the right motivations. What do I mean by the right motivations? Well, it's fine to be motivated by money, but that's not your only thing. You want to make a difference in the world. You want to have impact. You're motivated by what psychologists call intrinsic motivation, not just extrinsic or reward motivated reasons. So those are the some of the qualities that and a lot of that is teachable and learnable. So we do a robust business in executive coaching with leaders that A, understand that they can't be good in everything, and they want to, you know, they want to leverage their strengths and they want to address key weaknesses, and they avail themselves of coaching, which is a very bespoke or tailored way to address their skill development in various ways at critical times in the cycle of their building their business.
Yeah, that's great. I like that. I like the focus on emotional intelligence. And I was listening to something recently. We sort of suggested, you know, leaders talk, but maybe the skill of a leader is to listen. And I think perhaps that talks to that kind of idea of emotional intelligence. Perhaps if I can just close off one last question for each. We'll start with you, Ted, and then to you, Eugene. What advice would you give to a business leader now who perhaps feels the times are indeed disruptive, and it's not always easy to know what data to rely on, to know when to trust their gut feel, to perhaps struggle to surround themselves as well with the right folks because there is indeed a talent war outside raging. So what advice would you give, Ted?
I guess two points come to mind, Thomas. One would be the massive importance on always developing themselves. First of all, recognizing that they need to develop, and then taking every step to develop themselves. What does that mean? It means making sure you're getting enough honest, constructive feedback on a regular basis. No matter what you have to do to get it, make sure you're hearing the difficult messages. Make sure you're not surrounding yourself by yes people that are just agreeing with you, but that people will challenge you. And in terms of, you know, leading a business, I would say embrace diversity in all its forms. I mean, of course, you know, gender and race, but I'm really thinking even more so of diversity of thought. Make your organizations flatter. Realize that value creation can come increasingly from younger workers. Engage in reverse mentoring as it applies to digital technology and AI, for example. Put yourself in learning situations where you're going to be vulnerable. I think that's the key. CEOs and leaders that are willing to be vulnerable, that are willing to say, I don't know, teach me something about that, are really, really advantaged. So those two pieces of advice, Thomas, I would offer.
Thank you. And interestingly, diversity of thought is exactly how Eugene and I met for the first time a few years ago. Eugene, what advice would you give to a leader?
Yeah, two things. And I'd build on a really important point that Ted made. And Ted talked about emotional intelligence. And emotions are things that, you know, we have, whether we like it or not, they occur, and we have to learn how to manage them. And I think the same thing applies to our gut feelings, our hunches, our intuitions. We have them. We don't have a choice. They simply happen. And therefore, I think alongside emotional intelligence, I'd make a plea for leaders to develop their intuitive intelligence. In other words, a way to understand their intuitions, to know when they should and when they shouldn't use it, to develop their expertise so that they can exercise their expert intuition, you know, and have got all those dots that they can connect together to make creative outcomes. And then my second point would be, again, to pick up on a really great point that Ted made about, he talked about learnability and teachability. And I think what we can link that to is the idea of humility. And we've talked about hubris as a hazard and narcissism as a hazard and the links between them, but the hubris hazard. And I think if there is an antidote to the hubris hazard, I think it's humility. And what is humility about? I think humility is about, it's about self-regulation. It's about self-awareness. And above all, it's about the ability to learn and teachability, the ability to learn from anybody around you, from a diversity of people around you. Ted talked about learning from young people. So humble people are aware of their own strengths they're aware of their own limitations, and they're willing to be taught. And I think that to me would be a one would be a really key lesson, the idea of humility to move forward. Because, you know, leading a business, it's a journey, it's not a destination. It's a state of becoming rather than a being.
Thank you. Some very wise words. This has been an amazing conversation. So thank you very, very much, both of you, Ted and Eugene. And on this, basically, we end our first season of this podcast. Thank you, everyone, for tuning in. We hope to have many more of you for the second season, which will be launching anytime soon. And I just want to finish by saying goodbye and have a great day.